Welcome to this. Can't get away from that.
Radio
moment
tonight.
Sorry. Anyway, welcome to this jointly organized event between LSE Ideas through our China Foresight program, which Cherry's been very much involved in and is still, even though she's now gone over to the enemy at Chatham House, but we can forgive her. And also with our friends from the LSE Student Union China Development Forum. Let me just say straight away that one of the things we try and do in Ideas, and in fact do, is engage with the student union and with student societies as much as we can. We're constantly being told we've got to raise the student experience. Well, we actually do it, rather than just talk about it. So we've had very, very good relationships with the CDF, with the China Development Forum, with many, many other of the student bodies here. And that's one of the things we ought to be doing. Research is all very well, but unless you can translate that into normal English to students, I don't think you're doing the job you should be doing. In Wales, by the way, the word for professor is yr'athro, which actually means teacher, which I think is a damn good translation. It's the only Welsh I know, too, by the way. But it also conveys the sense that what you've got to do is to convey your knowledge and to the students at this university and indeed around the world. We've got a particular topic here tonight on China's peaceful rise. Whether you want to put a question mark after that or not, I'll leave up to you. There are two seats down the front, by the way. And then we've got another phrase called the Thucydides trap. Now, one of the things I do in my spare time, or not so much spare time, is teach a wonderful group of executive masters from many countries in the world, including China, India, and all places east, south, north, and west. And one of the essays they're doing is on the Thucydides trap. That's why so many of them are here this evening, because they want to know what the answer is to the essay question that has to be in on the 4th of February. But not all of you are doing that executive master. So anyway, fantastic to see many of you here tonight, both my students and many, many others besides. We have four wonderful speakers here tonight, and I'll just introduce them in a moment. The reason we've asked this question tonight, because it's important. The peaceful rise was, of course, a theory or formula that the Chinese authorities developed in the early part of the 21st century. It was taken very seriously. It was discussed. It was debated, theorized, conceptualized, historicized, to think about how China as a rising power could rise within the system and not to disturb the system as it previously happened with the rise of other great powers in history, from France in the late 18th century to Germany and Japan and the Soviet Union and indeed the United States in the 20th century. When powers rise, they tend to be rather disturbing consequences as a result. And of course, the question that people are asking today is whether or not the rise of another power, in this case China, is also disturbing the system. And whether or not, and this gets us to the second part of it, whether we are then being led into what the great Greek historian of the Peloponnesian Wars, namely Thucydides, called a trap, which has now been called the Thucydides trap, which in essence suggests, and he suggested it over 2,000 years ago, in probably one of the best books ever written on international relations, in my very humble opinion. In that particular book, he suggested very strongly that the rise of Athens created fear and insecurity with Sparta, which was indeed the underlying and least discussed reason for what followed in the great wars between the great city-states. And, of course, that notion of Thucydides' trap has now become very contemporary because it's much talked about not only in the United States. Graham Allison has created a whole Thucydides' trap industry at Harvard, but also in Beijing itself, where clearly China writers and policymakers are talking very, very much about this and whether or not we can avoid what that trap means. Well, indeed, we need to discuss what that trap is. Are we now in it? And if we're not in it, how can we avoid it? So those are the kind of questions we are going to talk about this evening. We've got four speakers. I'm going to start with Barry Bazan. Professor Bazan, who doesn't need any introduction to you here, one of the world's most renowned scholars of international relations, and I'm also pleased to say a very good friend of mine. We're then going to move over to Christopher Coker, another world-renowned IR scholar, and yet again, pleased to note he's a very good friend of mine, who works with me as director of LSC Ideas. We're going to move then to Cherry, who's worked with us here in Ideas for many years, and as I said, rather flippantly at the beginning, has moved over to Chatham House, where she leads, I think, the Asia program over there, who'll be looking at some of the Chinese debates in and around this, and providing what I think Cherry will believe will be a much more nuanced perspective on what China is thinking and what we should be talking about, really. And then last, but by no means least, Jeffrey over here. Jeffrey, you have spoken with us many times before, who will talk about some of the economic aspects of this, because in the end, I suppose, much of this does come back to economics. I'm going to give each speaker 10 to 12 minutes each max, and then we'll move over to questions and answers, I hope. So, Barry, over to you. Thank you very much. Barry Bazan.
Do we turn these things on?
I don't know. I just shout. So that makes,
makes no difference. Have a bigger voice.
I have a very loud voice. Yeah.
Can you hear me at the back?
Yes.
Wait, can you hear?
Okay.
Just about.
Let me start by testing the wisdom of crowds here. How many of you in this room think that there will be a war between China and another great power sometime in the next 20 years? Hands up.
One. Is that it?
Two.
Two.
Oh, I like to put my hand.
Three. Okay. Four. All right. So, wisdom 4.5. Some people are a bit slow.
Some don't want to tell you what they think.
This suggests that if the question is, can China rise peacefully, you think the answer is yes. Right? Four of you think it's no, but most of you think it's yes in some way or other. Now, the question of peaceful rise has to be a little bit unpicked, because you can have the obvious binary would be peaceful rise and warlike rise. There are plenty of cases of warlike rise, Japan, Russia, France, Germany, Britain, all of them rose through that traditional mechanism of war fighting with other great powers. We could argue about the United States. But really, this is a bit of a spectrum. It's not just a simple choice between peaceful rise and warlike rise. If we rule out If we go with your wisdom of crowds here, and we rule out warlike rise, then that leaves, I think, three options within peaceful rise. One of them would be a cold peaceful rise, which would be like a cold war, lots of shoving and pushing, nastiness, lack of trust, blah, 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 but no actual hot war. A bit better than that would be something like a security regime, where there were some rules of the game, but you could still get a war, but it was fairly well ordered. Or, best of all, it could be a kind of hot, peaceful rise, where everybody loved everybody else, and everybody got on, and there was really no question. It was a security community that there was no question of war at all. I think the argument I want to make is that looking in balance at all of the factors pro and con, China is probably heading for a cold peaceful rise. Now, China has had a whole variety of positions on this. China's foreign policy has been nothing if not heroically inconsistent. So, under Mao Zedong, you could make a pretty good case that that was a revolutionist power and was prepared to go for a warlike rise if need be. Under Deng Xiaoping, you had this peaceful rise, or peaceful development, as the government eventually came to prefer to call it. Not quite clear whether this was just a sneaky transitional tactic by Deng Xiaoping, basically to cover a period of Chinese weakness and therefore be nice to everybody for a while until China had sufficient strength to be getting on with the grittier business of bullying people, or whether it was, as it might have been, I don't know the answer to this, but it could, at least in principle, have been a permanent strategy, in which case it was a tremendous revolutionary idea, which unfortunately has largely gone by the board. But it would have been a very radical grand strategy for China had they followed it through. Now we're into what Yan Shuitong calls striving for achievement. That looks to me like cold, peaceful rise, fairly square. If we look at the factors that lean in either direction, in favor of peaceful rise. I mean, there's quite a lot of things that pull in either direction. So if you want to look at things that would militate against peaceful rise and push a bit more towards the nastier side of things, I mean, you could look at the way in which the Chinese Communist Party has cultivated an anti-Japanese, anti-American victimhood style of nationalism since the 1980s, which paints it into a corner. Right? So the Communist Party cannot be seen to be weak. Otherwise, it will be outflanked by nationalist opinion, and that's the last thing it wants to be. So the Chinese government is a little bit unstable in the sense that it has to react strongly to stuff. It can't appear weak. So it's a self-created problem to do with the particular insecurities of the Chinese Communist Party. It might also be argued that in the region there are unpredictable flashpoints, Taiwan, Korea most obviously, where not quite clear how or why things might take a turn there, but you would have to allow a possibility that things could go off the rails in either place and drag China into a conflict it didn't want. Now, you might also think that another factor here is hubris. I think there's a good case for somebody, maybe one of you out there can do it. Somebody needs to write a reprise of Senator Fulbright's old book on America, which he called The Arrogance of Power. It was probably a good book to be written about Chinese arrogance of power, which, if you look at Chinese foreign policy rhetoric, is very clearly there. Not universally, but it's a thread. And if that thread became dominant, then that might increase things. If you look at the factors pulling more in favor of peaceful rise, I think the principal ones would be the very standard ones. Everybody's afraid of a nuclear war and doesn't want it. None of the principal players want a war. They all want to appear strong, but nobody's looking for a war in the same way that, say, the Germans and up to a point the Japanese were looking for a war in the 1930s and 40s. That doesn't mean that a war is impossible, but there's a difference between a situation in which people are actually looking for war or quite prepared to resort to war and where they'd actually rather not and would be very hesitant to get dragged in. Again, because of the insecurities of the Communist Party, the Communist Party cannot afford to lose a war, right? Or even to come out looking as if it lost a war or coming off second best in a crisis, because that would be a huge loss of face and would put, I think, the legitimacy of the party into question. So this is, again, part of itself having painted itself into a corner, that it can't afford to lose, and it knows it's still relatively weak militarily, and therefore would be hesitant to get into anything too serious. The economic interdependence line, I think, is still significant. In addition to general fear of war, the Chinese economy is dependent on a functioning global trading system. To break that system would have quite large domestic costs in China, and this would also play into the ruling insecurities of the Communist Party. So there's an interesting balance of things, I think, but on the whole, that suggests to me that we're heading towards a cold, peaceful rise. This, I think, is likely to be a quite long and drawn-out period. You can see the dynamics of Trump and Abe and Xi all play into this kind of arrangement. There isn't, it seems to me, going to be a central competition between China and the United States for who dominates the world, as there was between the United States and the Soviet Union. What we're seeing here is a local competition. It's about who's dominant in Asia, and that's quite a different game from the Cold War one. I would worry more about the United States in this game than I would worry about China. The Americans, I think, are going to have more difficulty adjusting to their decline from superpowerdom to mere first amongst equals in a group of great powers. So on balance, the case I would make to you is cold, peaceful rise, but not a warlike rise.
Thank you very much, Barry. And over to Christopher Coker. Christopher.
Thank you. Let me just paint a picture of the world for you. A power that is number one threatened with becoming number two. A power with the largest navy in the world that can blockade the other country's coast in a way that the other country can't blockade its own. A power with the greatest soft power in history, and a language which is the international language. And a country that sees itself as the global hegemon, setting the rules of the system with things like a world currency underpinning a liberal world order. So it's not a bad description of the United States, I think you'll agree, except I'm not describing the United States, I'm describing Britain in 1895,
yes, exactly.
The last time that it contemplated going to war against the United States. The last time the United States contemplated going to war against Britain was 1938. The competition between the US and the UK is one of the few examples that our friend Graham Allison likes to cite of two countries that managed to escape the Thucydides trap. So we have to ask, what were the reasons for this, and what are the absent reasons today with regard to the US and China? Now, first is storytelling. International relations is about telling yourself a story, and the British told themselves some interesting stories. One was that the 20th century was going to be the American century. By the way, Britain was the only country to tell itself that. There was a book called The Americanization of the World in 1902 by W.T. Stone, who went down in the Titanic a few years later. there were talks about the English-speaking world. Bismarck, the last interview he ever gave with a journalist just before he died, when he was asked the most significant factor in the 20th century, he said that the United States would be speaking English. I only mention this because the Germans, both in the run-up to the First and Second World Wars, took no regard of the United States whatsoever. The British had noticed that America's rise was inevitable and came to terms with it in the 1890s. And thirdly, we had some wonderful stories, like social Darwinism, for example. Very important, that one. These two countries were racially the same, Anglo-Saxon countries. And before you begin talking about America as a nation of immigrants, just at the moment that the British told themselves this story, people like Henry James were writing a book, The American Scene, complaining about massive East European immigration into the United States that was undermining the Anglo-Saxon basis of American society. So in other words, two countries were talking much the same language. They were both normatively on the same relay race team. So it didn't really matter if Britain didn't actually cross the finishing line first. It still got the gold medal for being on the same team. That's completely missing today. And if you'd listened to Michael Pompeo's video link talk at Davos last week, you'd have seen that he's still mentioning the same themes of American liberal internationalism that you may have heard John Mearsheimer criticizing a few weeks ago. Criticizing China's state-centric model, criticizing it for being a totalitarian society. Mm-hmm. Same things picked up, by the way, by Mike Pence, the vice president, in his major speech in October, often called by commentators at the time the beginning of the new Cold War between the United States and China, talking about the Chinese agenda being similar to Khrushchev's agenda in 1959, where Khrushchev famously went to America and said, "We want to bury you." So in other words, we are a long way from the Shanghai communique in 1972, which was the agreement between those two powers not to enter into a normative debate about each other's respective political systems, but to work on the basis that they were different and would remain different for a very long time. So there's no story that the United States can tell itself about decline, relative or absolute, as you wish to interpret it. And as long as the United States cannot tell itself such a story, I think the US is going to be fairly miffed about the situation. Mm. Number two, the US and the UK had no territorial claims against each other at the beginning of the 20th century. In fact, in 1902, the Royal Navy finally withdrew from the Caribbean and left the entire Western Hemisphere in the hands of the United States. China is the only great power whose territorial extent and borders are disputed by the United States. China has signed treaties with every country, with one exception, India, where you still have an undemarcated border. But that situation, I think, will resolve itself in due course. The United States does not recognize Taiwan as being part of China and doesn't recognize, of course, the Senkuku Islands either. That, I think, is a very important point. And by the way, if Graham Allison had actually read Thucydides, as opposed to just glossing it, he would have realized that Thucydides doesn't actually say that the rise in Athens and the fact that Sparta's status quo power was the cause of the war. He's actually said it was their client states who seduced them into going to war by saying, you know, you really should be worried about Athens and you really should be worried about Sparta. So if you're concerned about the extent to which client states involve each other in unnecessary confrontations, Taiwan, I think, is still a major powder keg and it's waiting to explode at some point. And just one thing about the territory of the South China Seas, which the United States Navy claims, of course, has been violated by China. One also have to remember that two-thirds of all the shipping that goes through the South China Seas either comes from China or goes to China. In other words, it has a commercial interest in that region of the world, which the United States does not have. And if you're worried about the Spratly Islands, if you ever look at the navigational maps, you'll see the Spratly Islands are defined as islands to be avoided, because they're rather dangerous to navigate in that area. So I wouldn't actually think it's worth going to war over the Spratly Islands, quite frankly. And then thirdly, I wrote in my book, The Improbable War, the reason why great powers go to war against each other, and that has been the case, I think, for the last 300 years, certainly in Europe, is over the rules of the road, over the international system. Whose international system is it? Who is the predominant power? Whose institutions have been built up? And I would say that we are at a critical moment where the United States has not yet adjusted to a very significant change or shift, as we would say, global shift in power. Mm. Remember, in 1973, China was, in terms of GNP, had less GNP than the District of Columbia. So that what you have is a rise of a country, peaceful or not, which has been unprecedented in history, particularly in peacetime. In 1990, the United States was so dominant as the number one power that, in fact, it wasn't even worth talking about a number two power. In 2020, it will be the number one power just. By 2030, it will probably be the number two power. Now, compare this with the Cold War, of course, which the United States was always going to win. If it allowed, without a nuclear explosion, we were going to allow the balance of history to tip in the inevitable direction. 1947, the United States had an economy three times the size of the Soviet Union. 1990, when the Cold War came to an end, it had an economy 10 times the size of the then Soviet Union. The main problem, it seems to me, at the moment, and which is why I think there's a 50-50 chance of war in the next 10 to 15 years, is that we have a political vacuum. We have a United States that simply is at the moment unwilling to defend its international order, but still insists on all the prerogatives of being a hegemonic power. So it's a hegemonic power that doesn't obey its own rules, which I think is a first in American history. And we have a China that doesn't know what it wants to do. It doesn't know whether it wants to continue bending the rules, as it has in the South China Seas, because it, in fact, is a very great breach of international law there. It doesn't want to break them, like Russia, because it doesn't need to, but it doesn't know what it wants the new rule book to look like. And thus you have two countries that are basically squaring off each other with no basis on which to have a dialogue about how to revise the international system. But I will conclude on a somewhat different note. I've spent a lot of time looking at the causes of war, and in the end, they're not always structural and they're not always historical, and that's the problem with the Thucydides trap. They're usually accidental. Countries find themselves at war despite, as Barry has just said, despite their best intentions. Nobody wants a war. You're going to get one if there is a naval confrontation in the South China Seas, if a ship is sunk, if a plane is shot down, if there's a violent response by the United States to a major cyber espionage event in the United States, if there's a provocative act by the Chinese government because of status anxiety and it needs to stand up for itself or be seen standing up for itself. So I looked at my book in the end at probabilities and I came to the conclusion that there are some events which are so unlikely it's really not worth discussing them at meetings like this, like an alien invasion. Why not think about that? It's a possibility. Or the second coming of Christ, which Mike Pence is looking forward to during his lifetime. Or the Gulf Stream going into reverse the day after tomorrow, that wonderful film which I saw three times because it appeals to my pessimistic nature. By the way, the Pentagon was tasked with looking at the possibility of the Gulf Stream going in reverse about 4 or 5 years ago, and it can go into reverse in your lifetime, so you should be perhaps a little concerned about that. And then an event which is improbable but quite possible for two reasons. A, everyone's talking about it, which wasn't the case 5 years ago, and B, everyone is preparing for it, just in case. So I leave you with a quote by General Mattis shortly before he stepped down from office, saying that sure, terrorism is important, but the great power competition is now the number one issue on our security agenda. And I can assure you it's also the number one issue on China's security agenda. And so what are the chances of avoiding a Sino-American war? I would say they were what I said they were a few years ago, 50-50, which, by the way, is not bad historically. Those are actually quite good odds, but a little too close, perhaps, to call.
Thank you very much, Christopher. And we'll pass over now to Cherry. I think that does work, Cherry. If
you... Okay. Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, perfect. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. I'm so glad to be back. Mick, can I ask you a big favour?
No.
Could we extend the essay deadlines of those students? Because
No, absolutely no way.
Right, because
absolutely no. Quiet down there.
Well, because obviously
irreverent students in the audience. You're being provocative.
Well, I'm not trying to be provocative. What I'm trying to sense in here is that so-called great power competition will likely to happen or have some kind of result to be achieved over this weekend.
Oh, okay.
Regarding what's going on. So that's why I'm asking, perhaps, you know, you require a different assessment.
We'll review the situation through the National Security Council.
Anyway, just to continue what I try to present in here is, so when we come to talk about great power or what kind of great power China is, three words come to my mind. All the three words are beginning with the letter M, which is might, money, and mindset. And obviously, China exercising its own economic and military might, like the Americans, like the Russians have done in the past, but also China using its enormous financial resources and trying to pursue a political influence, pursue that sense of economic statecraft. And lastly, not least, from China by no way shared a common ideology and same values with the so-called liberal democracy and somehow forcefully promote its own values within the region and across the world. So these are the three M's somehow China used to project its own power. But when I come to talk about three M's, and it has some kind of differentiation in here as well. On the one hand, we're talking about, we have foreseen this enormous powerful political party have 88 million population being the members and to pursue, you know, a national grand strategy. But then on the other hand, we also foresee a China, which is a country with the world's largest income inequality as well. So how are we going to square the circle, square the irreconcilable in a way? And the answer is we don't know. Now, when we're talking about China's international outlooking, the worldview, or we're talking about whether China want to change or revolutionize the existing international system, and my answer is, let's do not quickly jump on the conclusion that China is going to seeking for a parallel international order, and that's actually underestimate what China is trying to do. And actually, China's strategy in here is, because of the sheer size of China, because of the size of the economy, even if President Xi are not in power anymore, and China's behavior will still continuously heroically inconsistent, and by using your word, which is to pick and choose to see which system is benefiting for China. So using the financial term, China's strategy to pursue international affairs is actually a sense of portfolio diversification. I'm sure Jeffrey will explain to you on what that means by that terms. Put it in a simple language, which is you do not putting all the eggs in the one basket. So classic example is, once we're talking about China trying to challenging the existing international order by building separate multinational financial institution, and if the AIIB, the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, and if you actually carefully look at the governance structure of AIIB, look at the top 10 projects that's been analyzed and been adapted by the AIIB, you don't find much differences between AIIB or Asia Development Bank, ADB, which is very much a Washington consensus-led development bank. So on the economics governance side, and I don't really think China is looking for revolutionize, overturn the existing system, but somehow try to make the system speak a much louder voice for China itself. But also, this is what largely the emerging economies are looking for as well, adding extra chairs, adding extra voting shares. So this is what China intend to do. And secondly, on some areas, China actually does looking for seeking the challenge existing order. And two areas which I foresee would be on the maritime sector. Christopher just mentioned on the South China Sea dispute, and what China has done is disregard whatever goes on with the international law and international practice instead, China forcefully put forward to a historical claim on South China Sea belongs to China historically. And on the second area, the area has been much contested in nowadays, is on the cyberspace. Now, President Xi has this a really interesting view, believe somehow the cyberspace would be within the stream of national sovereignty, and therefore China and China's government has its own sole right to decide what is right or wrong within the cyberspace. Obviously, this is very different from the rest of the world, considering the cyberspace is a transnational space. So the debate and context ongoing. And these are the certain areas China does agree with the existing system, and certain areas China don't agree. So that's what I said, we should really treat the views with a nuance. But the two things I foresee in the past few years on this debate between China and the West, these are two things would challenge Xi Jinping himself, and the two things would challenge China. The two things, firstly, is these matter more than words. And what I recall is, since January 2017, President Xi seems to enjoyed his Davos moment as portrayed himself being the champion for economic globalization. And of course, this is really music to the ear to the Western capitalist. But what happened was, the rest of the world are waiting for China's deeds on economic reform. Instead, what we have, and what we have is we have an ever-strengthened Communist Party try to interfere every single aspect of the business decisions of the economy, but also interfere the everyday life of the people. So does that really match what his words, but, you know, talking about liberalization? If liberalization, what kind of liberalization and reform he's talking about? So there's a whole notion on these and words, and somehow firstly disappointed the Westerners, but also disappointed somehow the Chinese people themselves. And secondly is particularly on the Chinese foreign affairs. It seems to be we are a country only merged to the center of international stage since 1979. So there are many views we want to conduct the foreign policy is very much a self-centered. We seem to look at the world through the lenses of the Chinese rather than from the lenses of the others. So at the end of the day, what we have to admit is, irrespective how many good and perfect and positive initiative we like to put forward to, you know, such as Belt and Road, is a very good idea. But then how the rest of the world going to acting on the interpretation and how, what China can do, and most importantly, the interaction with China and what the rest of the world are fear from. And so far for the moment, I haven't really seen a very much clear answer from Beijing. So I think fundamentally, if China wants to really come to the way, or Xi Jinping wants to make China great again, these are the two fundamental challenges, and he has to answer within the second and third terms of his line. So I'll end in here, and look forward to have Jeffrey explaining on the portfolio diversification. Thank you.
And all students disregard her remarks about the essay, by the way. Jeffrey, over to you to bring an economist perspective to all this geostrategy.
So portfolio diversification is don't put your eggs in one basket. Just make sure whatever you invest in is all with one bank, i.e. UBS.
Part of political broadcast there. Yeah. We'll charge you for that.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Just below 150 basis points, please. Right, so... Now, when we actually think about asset allocation, I'll tell you where I'm getting with this in a second. We often tell clients you've got the long-term tactical view, sorry, the long-term strategic view, you know, over 5 to 7 years of business cycle, over an economic cycle where various assumptions should hold, versus a short-term tactical view, you know, where you, you know, just can take advantage of mispricings in markets over the shorter term. When it comes to China's economic policy, since, you know, Deng Xiaoping sort of left, even though most governments, most administrations have pledged to think strategically. It still seems like in an era where the low-hanging fruit has been picked and economic growth is harder to come by, what looks like a strategic view is actually just a series of tactical views in disguise. Right. So basically, it's always reactive. It's not reacting. It's not actually planning with a longer-term vision. And this is quite interesting when you think about, you know, Western democracies and governments have to worry about the next opinion poll, which will, you know, determine, you know, where their economic policies are. The old adage is, you know, China actually shouldn't have to worry about that. But in truth, and as much as probably the administration in Beijing would not want to admit this, their fundamental legitimacy still, for the time being, comes from delivering economic growth and prosperity, right, for the people, for everyone, the middle class and the tier one, tier two cities, and also for those in the countryside. And the way I see it right now, China's actually, well, the government is failing to deliver that side of the bargain, right? Because when you have a population which has been expecting, and with good reason, of, you know, 5 to 10%, your double-digit income growth on an annualized basis, you know, 5 to 10% house price growth and asset performance growth, whereas, you know, last year your wages stagnated, so your property prices are stagnated, property market, Chinese equity markets fell about 18%, and all the other rubbish like P2Ps and wealth management products not sold by UBS, you know, they just basically collapsed, right? So you are finally seeing a wealth effect on the population and also a lack of direction. I actually see this as a good thing, right? Insofar as if there's a wealth effect in China, especially amongst middle-class Chinese, then it means economically they're starting to behave, you know, like the West. You know, in the UK, in the Western Australia, in the US in particular, once house prices or your wealth, you know, comes off, we see how it affects spending, right? But the question right now is, and here's why I'm a bit more optimistic on the overall outlook, even over the medium to longer term, is what is the government's response on an economic basis? So you could I could actually see a case where right now economic pressures, you have two choices. You either take the tough medicine and actually try to reorient all the efforts right now to rebalance the economy towards a more sustainable footing. You've got to calibrate expectations first amongst the domestic populace, but focus on delivering your side of the bargain for that compact, you know, with the people. Or you could choose the opposite, which we've seen in the past, amongst, you know, many countries where the economic legitimacy starts to run out of room, and then you use nationalism. I think, you know, Argentina being a very good example in 1982, right? And we saw the results, you know, after that. And I think there are certain parallels which can be drawn there as well, right? So what is the challenge, you know, right now to reorient China towards, you know, the strategic view? And might surprise you to, you know, hear me say this, but one thing I don't think Xi Jinping, for now, is given enough credit for is probably his willingness, for whatever reason, to accept lower economic growth, but on a sustainable basis, might actually, his pain threshold might actually just be a bit higher than what markets are expecting right now, right? So we're in this very perverse psychology where every piece of bad news on the data side in China is actually welcomed by financial participants because, oh dear, bad data, China's worried, they've got to do a big bang stimulus like 2009, I've got to buy commodity block companies, I've got to buy the Australian dollar, blah, 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 I've got to buy Chinese property, right? But so far, especially if you look at the Ministry of Finance, you know, they are not going down this route, right? So if there is a concerted effort by Beijing to actually, you know, try to sue for peace on the trade war as quickly as possible, and it's incredible that both sides are still, as much as they can, trying to separate the Huawei issue with the trade talks issue, though timing-wise suggesting, you know, that's going to be harder to do. But assume, you know, just for the sake of assumption, that they can be separated. If China can sue for peace, and we'll find out soon enough, another reason to extend your deadlines until after March, you know, rather than February. So after the MPC, if the reports are right that for this year China's still going to run a budget position which would make the Germans proud, right, then it is a sign that economically they have the right priorities, right? This is a really important point because actually it means growth is still going to be weak but on a sustainable level and we can achieve the rebalancing, you know, that's needed, right? But it requires leadership from the top, right? Now, whether Xi Jinping will be able to deliver that and put the Sino-US struggle to the side, I'll try not to make a call, but let's give Beijing the benefit of the doubt, you know, for the time being. Now, the counterexample, right? What if, right, they go down the opposite route of panicking, and here's where things can actually take a sharp turn for the worse because all routes will probably, you know, turn back to, you know, crisis scenario because you will have a situation where you can get a short-term sugar rush for 6 or 12 months, but then all the debt issues that have accumulated in China since 2009, which have not been resolved, you know, by the way, that's only going to get worse. You know, debt to GDP, 300%, 400%, you know, pick a number. And if you want to maintain relative stability within your currency, right, then that's going to cost a boatload of reserves and then you're not going to be left with anything else. And ultimately, you might still want to deliver economic prosperity, but if Beijing runs out of options, you know, then you run the risk of playing the nationalist card, right? So the economic decisions that China will make, you know, over the next 12 months or so, so thrust upon itself, I think will be critical in determining which path China will take whether to continue slowly rebalancing and integrating itself into the global economy to actually make war so costly for everyone involved, or go down another route. Now, I must admit, the US is actually pushing China towards a separate pole to actually disintegrate the global trading framework at this point, which is relatively dangerous. So I think, you know, one aspect is so offshoring from China, so where all the production is being moved away, you know, due to security concerns and others. So it might benefit Southeast Asia, but a lot of the jobs are going to go back to the US as well. So that creates employment issues within China, but it's also seen as economic warfare. The Huawei issue, you know, that's also another angle as well. If you ask me if there's one economic matter that keeps me awake at night, is to your point, the dollar, the global reserve currency, right? There is absolutely no alternative to that right now, whether Beijing wants to admit that or not, right? So in the worst case scenario, you run into a situation where the US announces any company, right, or any bank that dares to extend a loan to any Chinese firm of interest, right? Let's assume it's called Huawei, will be shut out from dollar clearing, right? Then this will hurt the US a lot, but guess what? The US can actually print dollars to save itself, to save its own financial institutions. Then any bank, any company that still wants to deal with the US and the US consumer, and whether we like it or not, the US consumer is still the world's driving force, the world economy's driving force, will be forced to cut its ties, you know, with any Chinese institution in question, right? So pardon the pun, this is still the trump card, you know, that the US has. And if I had to pick, like, a trigger for conflagration, for outright economic warfare and retaliatory, you know, options, an economic trigger which could cause, you know, something, you know, far more pernicious, it will probably be via the dollar transmission channel. And China has not done enough, and I think there's a security issue or there's a lack of confidence issue. China doesn't want the renminbi to internationalize. For the simple reason, if you own something, you can sell it as well. So why hold the line at 7 to the dollar right now? It makes no economic sense, right? So again, you know, hopefully, and I end on this note, hopefully, you know, China can actually take the pain, allow some depreciation, really, you know, use the framework they have now to rebalance the economy and just focus on that. Because the end point is, you know, they will then the government will perhaps be able to deliver on the economic legitimacy and then so move away from this status anxiety as being talked about, and you know, just make, you know, bilateral relations and multipolar relations much easier. So still try to be optimistic.
Good. We needed a little bit. Well, Barry spoke about a cold, peaceful rise. Christopher gave us 50-50. Cherry gave us subtlety. And a good economist gave us optimism. I just want to make one or two brief points. Maybe talk on the US side a little bit more, because although most of you said something, I want to say a little bit more. I've written about U.S. foreign policy in the U.S. for many, many years. And I, for want of doing something better at night, I decided to read through every U.S. national security statement over the last 2 years on China. And indeed, even read President Trump's speeches during and before his presidency on China. And I'd like to say that Trump is an outlier. That Trump is not America, that Trump is something out of the ordinary, and we're going to get back to normal on the issue of China. After reading all these extraordinarily boring but important documents, and most important documents tend to be rather boring, I'd rather come to a more pessimistic conclusion, Jeffrey, to be perfectly honest, because there's a kind of a way in which what has been happening, and it's not just Trump, and it's not just the Republicans, the Democrats have bought into this too, it seems, if not more so, because they would then raise other issues like labor standards, human rights, and all the other kind of questions. In a way, Republicans historically have, in a sense, been more realist on China, and the Democrats, in a sense, more problematic. So it seems to me there's a kind of an emerging consensus in the United States. I think we'd be foolish, and I'm not saying you are, but we'd be foolish to think it's just the Trump question. There's something going on which seems to be deeper and structural on the US side. And it seems to be there's two things which have been going on. One, what Trump has been saying has touched a wider base than just his base. In other words, on the, you know, decline of manufacturer, this worry about the US being challenged by China 2025, all this kind of stuff together. I think that's touched a much wider base. There is a bit of a consensus in the United States. Trump doesn't build consensus, but on one thing it seems to me he's built more of a consensus, at least, not completely, on this aggressive trade strategy. The other thing is, I'm not, the second thing I'd say is whether or not, and therefore one has to be a bit more pessimistic looking at the US side of things. You looked at the China side of things. On the US side, I kind of look rather pessimistically. I don't think public opinion is suddenly going to swing, be nice to China. The corporations are ambiguous about China anyway. Some want tough trade and some want access to the China market. So they want both. But they're not certainly criticizing Trump as much as one would have thought they might do, given that some of their markets are going to be affected. The other thing is, if you actually look at what they're saying, they here being Pence, and go back to the national security strategy document of the Trump administration in December 2017, the language is quite straightforward. You know, China is a revisionist power. You know, it's there. I mean, it's not totally unambiguous. It may not be a Cold War. It may not be a hot war. It may be 50-50. They're not talking about that. They're saying China is a revisionist power. It's not a stakeholder. That word has gone out of the language on the US side. And looking at the demands that the US is putting forward, it doesn't seem to me it's really about soybeans, pigs, and aeroplanes. That is part of it. The deficit issue is part of it. But what it seems to me the US is talking about is something deeper. They're kind of looking for structural economic change, you know, within the Chinese economy, which is actually really like it was regime change, but we don't want to use that terminology. And that again raises the stakes, it seems to me, to much, much higher level, because underneath the Pence speech or things that Trump has been saying, and not only, again, I've had to read through all these wretched Senate and House reports on the Chinese economy. Nonetheless, what they're talking about, we are in a systemic conflict with the state-owned enterprise order, that we need fundamental changes in the way China does business, the way it steals our technology. You know, it's a whole raft of things. I mean, put South China Seas to one side for the second, you know, put the other stuff, the more hardline security stuff. You know, that seems to me getting at pretty fundamentals, because it's actually saying the way the Chinese economy is run. Now, we know that the economy is all about politics in China, and it's therefore about the Communist Party's control over the economy or its management of that. So it seems to me I didn't have any views when I went into looking at all this dreadful stuff, but I had to do it because that's what I'm paid to do, and I'm a fairly sad individual like most academics. But having done it, I came out at the other end of it by about January the 3rd of this year after several drinks, thinking, well, actually, this is looking far more serious. And it's not just about the strategy side. It's not just about the weaponry. It's about a deeper economic conflict. And the regime change is not a term that the Americans themselves use. But if you kind of add it all up, that's what it adds up to. So I do come out rather more on the pessimistic side. The other thing is the American economy itself is also bound to be under problems as well, is it not? I mean, Trump is still under economic pressure to kind of... But he thinks he can win a trade war. And this is what is... Who mentioned the word hubris? Barry. You know, Trump's in a very hubristic moment. I know he's not going to get his wall. And he may have to retreat a bit on the trade side. But, time and again, Trump has said, we can win this. Now, that's pretty dangerous. Pretty dangerous, I think. But anyway, I just throw those comments out because it is the US that's going to determine this. We've talked a lot about the China side, but I think maybe we also need to bring in the US side, because on that side, it seems to me, I come out really much more pessimistic than I was on December the 25th last year. Anyway, those are my few comments. Do you want to come back on that at all, Jeffrey, or anybody, and then any follow-up comments, and then we'll open up.
We do focus on the US side. You know, so firstly, if you really do, you know, take Trump at his words, and probably we should, he will, react to the way the stock market's behaving at the end of the day. And I think you don't need, Nobel Prize winners to advise him that trade wars are not there to be won, right? So it is, you know, damaging the US economy right now. You are seeing it in earnings, you are seeing it in forecasts. So it's in his interest, you know, not to go for a Pyrrhic victory, right? You know, whereby, okay, you may have won the war in China's suit for peace, and the S&P is down near 30%, which it looked like it, you know, so just on Christmas Eve, you know, we were within touching distance of a bear market. So I think, you know, that's where some realization come in. And even for your average Joe or Jane, you know, in the US, looking at the 401ks, they're going to see an impact, right? So that's something that the economic planners in the US, you know, that's where, you know, there's a self-correcting mechanism, right? But taking it from the over the medium to longer term, I think some of the points that the US makes, sure, you know, there are political motivations behind it, are perfectly valid, right? So this is where I go back to the economic, maybe the technocratic response on the Chinese side. So as in, so perhaps China should realize a state-driven model, if you don't have the right people at the top, is not the best way to grow. You know, just look at the numbers, look at demographics, you know, look at domestic demand. Mm. It's all falling. So perhaps domestically, this at least can engender some change, you know, some renewed discussion, as in, is guojianmintui, so the state advances at the expense of the people. Is this the right way forward? If they even manage to drop that, yeah, a few years of pain, and to actually reduce the scale of the state sector along the lines of the Zhongzhi reforms, you know, over two decades ago, but there is a way forward, right? So I still, so on the US side, I think, again, there are self-corrective mechanisms, but you know, China, hopefully, you know, can actually look, in, well, so take some lessons, you know, from some of the accusations as well. Yeah. There, if want to be a bit more, you know, hesitant, you know, so I can perfectly understand that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Barry, you want to come in and share, maybe Christopher as well,
Yeah, a couple of things. On your point about China being a revisionist power, I think we need a dose of cherry here and the nuance of
I'm quoting the Americans, because,
but I mean, it's not a simple dyad, okay. Mm. So China is obviously not a status quo power. That would be a ridiculous argument. So what kind of revisionist is it?
Is
and
it,
there are three kind of gradients of revisionism. One is I'm okay with the rules, but I want more status in the system. And China is definitely that kind of orthodox revisionist. Two is I want to change the rules, but I'm okay to do that within the processes, the legitimate processes of things, a kind of reformist revisionist. China's a little bit there, okay? And three is the kind of Mao Zedong version. You know, I want to change the goddamn rules, and I'll do it any way I possibly can.
We're not there.
And China is simply not there. So there's nothing wrong at all with China being trying to change its status. No problem about that. I mean, if the Americans are complaining about that, well,
do you think it just wants to revise the size of its chair around the table, or does it want a different table?
It seems mainly to want to revise the size of its chair.
Around the same
if you
table.
Actually look at it, you know, item by item, the Chinese are not actually contesting very much in terms of the basic rules of the game. Okay, so on Christopher's point, I think Christopher and I would probably agree that there's a very substantial risk in the present situation of escalation, of uncontrolled escalation, of accidental war, if you will, because you know the Chinese have this habit of painting themselves into the corner, and then you know that can lead to difficult decision making. But I think where we disagree is that we have different pictures of the world. Christopher, you described your vision as being based on the idea that there's an emerging political vacuum, which is a kind of 1930s. Vision in which you know everybody's going to be competing with everybody else to see who can dominate the world. I just don't think that's the kind of world we're moving into. I think we're in a different, something quite new, something, an order that is much more diffuse in the sense that we're moving to a situation where there'll be no superpowers. There's a great and ongoing distribution of wealth and power and also cultural authority. Right? So what you see draining away from the US is not just dominance in wealth and power, but also cultural authority. So it's a more diffuse system, a more regionalized system. There's no central competition. The Chinese do not want to own the world. They say that, and it's one of the few things I actually believe when the Chinese government speaks on that. They don't want to own the world. It's not about who's controlling or who's going to kind of dominate the future. It's not one of those big Cold War-type conflicts. I think even in this emerging system, which I would label deep pluralism, even the idea that any single power or group of powers has the right to play a hegemonic role in the system is itself becoming illegitimate. So we're into a different sort of international relations, and one, frankly, in which we have never been before. But I don't think that kind of assumption, that old kind of balance of power, that if there's a if there's a multipolar system, there must be conflict. I just don't think that that's the situation we're moving into at all. What we're moving into is a more diffuse system in which nobody wants to take control of the system, but there's quite a bit of agreement on the rules of the game.
I'll ask Christopher to come back and then Cherry, and then we'll open it up to the audience. Christopher.
Well, I wanted more to come back on your point rather than Barra's point. Okay. Barra, I didn't actually say the political value. The vacuum was the equivalent of the 1930s, or even very similar to the 1930s. But I just think there is a political vacuum at the moment. But on your point, Mick, there is no division between Republicans and Democrats. And by the way, there was no division in the 1890s between conservatives and liberals when it came to appeasing the United States
In this country.
In this country. Very pragmatic, as we had a conservative prime minister, Lord Salisbury, who said if we wanted to go to war against the United States, the American Civil War had been the time. We'd miss the opportunity and countries don't get two opportunities. That was British pragmatism, of course, which we don't see these days with the Brexit debate. But it's a wonderfully pragmatic attitude to take if you're the number one power at the time. No, there is no difference. The problem is that the United States has got itself into, I think, a bit of a strategic endgame here. It just does not know how to deal with China, and this for a number of reasons. First of all, the Chinese read their Sun Tzu and actually understand it. The Americans read Clausewitz and don't understand it. That's their misfortune. And Sun Tzu just says you win the battle, you win the war without firing a shot. And you win the battle before you even engage the enemy's forces. What do? You dismantle the alliance system. So basically what China will do over the next 10 years, and has already done with the Philippines, with a number of other countries, by the way, is just to dismantle the American alliance system bit by bit by making all sorts of offers that you cannot refuse. The key country, of course, is Japan. That's the most difficult, but I can assure you that even in Japan today, Abe, despite his attempted professed admiration for his golfing partner, Donald Trump, the Japanese don't trust the United States, and they are having to come to terms with the Chinese problem, and they will come to terms in their own way. I don't know how that will go. The second problem is that the Americans have always relied on a technological superiority over their enemy. From the days that they invented the machine gun, only they had it, to the days they took to the air for the first time, or the aircraft carrier, or the atomic bomb, or missiles. They don't now. Mm. And in three critical areas, in fact, they suspect that China is going to either overtake it or has already got near to parity. One is cyber warfare. Mm-hmm. The other is anti-satellite. I mean, after all, the Chinese have actually not one of their own satellites out of space. In 2007, the only country to have done that successfully. And the third is artificial intelligence. And the AI race, arms race, it's an arms race as well as a commercial race, has just begun. And there are two schools of thought, whether the Americans will succeed or whether the Chinese will succeed. I'm not going to put bets on either, but I'm just saying that in those three critical areas, for the first time in their history as a great power, they are dealing with, I would think, a peer competitor, which was never the case with the Soviet Union, was certainly never the case with either Nazi Germany or Imperial Germany. And if you are looking at that position, you will either go to war while you can, or you can do this, because the Americans, of course, do have an advantage, which Britain didn't have in the 1890s or after isolationism again. I mean, you can literally say you live in the safest neighborhood in the world. Basically, you're self-sufficient in energy. You don't need alliance systems. You don't need the Middle East any longer. And basically, you can come home. And that, I think, is a possibility that could split the political parties at some point. But at the moment, there is complete bipartisan support for Trump on what he is doing, just as there's complete bipartisan support, by the way, on Russia. Trump is an isolated figure within his own political party on Russia as well.
Well, some of the Democrats I read actually were worrying that Trump would do a deal on trade rather than he would do a deal, i.e. they were more worried that he would sell out on the position which they adopted to some degree. On the technology side, maybe Jeffrey would disagree with that, come back. On the technology side, one of the things, again, going through all this stuff that I went through in my rather sad Christmas, was the degree to which the question of China 2025 that made in China came up time and time and time again. Now, 10 years ago, one would not have had... Now, it may all be, you know, nonsense. It may be this is just, you know, misreading of what's really going on. It may not even be significant. Misperception is also another important part of this, but certainly comes up time and time again. And I never heard that 10 years ago. You might have heard about Chinese rising power in a general sense, but not that China was a technological competitor. You are hearing that now a lot more on the American side and on both sides. Anyway, come on today. We want in Q&A. Jerry, one last comment, and then we'll open up for
I mean,
to the
much
floor.
Agree with your bipartisan consensus in Washington regarding China. I think part of the reason we have seen him here is we need to see the causes why United States decided to establish a diplomatic relationship with China 1979. Mm. Partially it's because the United States would like to make China become more like the United States. But however, China has not really gone down that route. And China has pursued authoritarian regime with much stronger economy. So the United States somehow lost the confidence within their own system, decided, all right, okay, this perhaps is the last opportunity to confront China's rise. Mm. So that's, I mean, I would consider that's really the deep concern reason why there seems to be a bipartisan agreement in here. But secondly, what I also somehow blame the Chinese side, if we're talking about engagement with the United States, I think the Chinese so-called experts and somehow engaged with a certain part of the United States. And Chinese engaged with the part of the United States, which is read Wall Street Journal, study at Harvard, have a job in investment banking. But they really don't know the part of America who have largely voted for Trump in 2016 and again voted for Trump earlier last year in the midterm election. Mm. So we don't really now have another Henry Kissinger somehow within the administration, and we can find someone to talk to. So I see that's where the deadlock has come from.
Okay, good points. Okay, look, we've had a lot of good material from the front, I hope good speeches, except mine. Why don't we open it up for Q&A? Yeah, let's take two or three. There's one, two, three here, quickly, yeah. Make your questions quick, sharp and to the point. And only one point, please. I don't want lots of missiles. Three in one. Please, sir, who are you?
Thank you very much. I'm a former Italian diplomat. Thank you to LSC and...
Thank you.
...and the speakers. I would like to drop a question that is not specifically addressed to any of the speakers. Is how much do you believe this rising tension between the United States and China is related to a feature that is common to both countries, that is exceptionalism?
Ah.
Both countries in their history, the millenarian history of China and the more recent, the more short American history, are really attached to a sense of exceptionalism they have.
Mm.
And incidentally, if we go and see other two, let's say, enemies of the United States at the moment, Russia and Iran, both they have their own exceptionalism. So how much, in your view, this problem is related to the view that this country have of themselves and their role in the world? I totally agree with just you say that now we are evolving in a situation, if with George W. Bush we were during the terrorists, either you are with us or against us. Now, as you just say, in a way, and with the national security strategy, either you are like us or you are against us.
Yeah.
This is the evolution, and I totally agree with you. Thank you very much.
I love people agreeing with me. So if you could pass it along to the gentleman here, yeah? Then I'll bring it to the front. Yeah, hi.
Hi, Robert, student theology. So to Professor Buzan, you made the point that there's no regional rivalry right now between China and the U.S., and that's why we're not going to get to a flashpoint of war. But how does the Belt and Road Initiative and China's exposure to Africa, recently in Venezuela, we see that popping up as of last week, and then also the 16+1 Eastern European countries, how does that change that calculus with this new regional tension?
That's good. Was there a question over here? Did I have one over here? No, anybody else? Yeah, come on. Over here.
Thank you.
One question.
I on the essay, I cannot wait to...
He's one of my students, by the way.
...get it over with. I don't want the... I've
just marked you down already. Okay, yeah, carry on then.
Okay. I'd like to make a very brief comment here. Since I work for the Chinese government, I know there is differences, huge differences, among the decision makers, policy makers, when it comes to the United States. What they can all agree with each other is how important China's relations with the United States remain for the future. And there are certain people in the political spectrum in China who constantly use evidence to talk about containment, to accuse the United States of containing or trying to contain China's rise. And they are nationalists, and they are strong.
Mm.
And they make any Chinese president's job very difficult. In Obama's administration, it was TPP, pivot to Asia, and now Trump a lot more, certainly in the trade war. And for the Communist Party of China, their number one concern, in my personal view, is survival. And they feel existential threat from certain parts of the world, from some Americans, when they talk about, now, they don't talk about regime change, but they used to talk about peaceful evolution. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there are many people in China, in political and military circles, who have real worries about that, and very, at very high levels within the party. And I have one question for all the panelists. Could you say something about the issue of strategic distrust between these two countries?
Okay, great points. Thank you. I'll take a couple more, just go around. Young woman here, yeah, please. Hi. I guess you can. Take this one, I'll take a second round, okay? Yeah, please, hi.
Hi, my name is Spinia, and I want to ask a question about what is behind the President Trump of having blamed China for manipulating their currency, because those kind of accusations come through somewhat aggravating, so it doesn't really promote the diplomatic and cold rise of China.
Okay, well, I've got a question for you then, Jeffrey. Why don't we start with the currency question, on some of the
charges that the Trump puts forward on manipulated currency?
Ignore it. Okay. The Treasury, the US Treasury's semi-annual currency report, you know, which is very technically driven, couldn't find evidence. Actually, if you had to pick, you know, one country which might be close to manipulation based on their own criteria, it's probably Switzerland, right? You're bad for my job. Yeah, but you know, overall, I think that ship has sailed a long time ago, even amongst some of the economic hawks in China. If anything, so those hawks would argue. If you wanted to punish China, you'd get renminbi to fair value, which is probably short term, 10-15% lower than where they are right now. So I think that's a bit of red herring. Yeah.
That's an old story.
Yeah, it's an old story and not really a valid argument anymore.
Okay, okay.
And even the hawks know it in the US.
They do, yeah, and they don't actually talk about it very much now either, too. Christopher, do you want to pick up on any of those issues? Exceptionalism, maybe, to start off with?
Can I answer all three?
Sure, you do it,
as quickly as possible. On exceptionalism, yes, well, it's Obama. Got himself into a lot of trouble by saying that every country considers itself exceptional, and then, of course, he had to backtrack the following week and say, of course, the United States is exceptional in its own particular way. I'm not too worried about exceptionalism. I'm not sure that how many countries call themselves exceptional. This country used to call itself exceptional back in 1900. Most people at the peak of their power talk about exceptionalism. Jews talk about being exceptional, you know, covenant with God, the only people to have signed a covenant with God. But there was the Dutch philosopher Spinoza who said, of course, we Jews must hope that God loves us because there's no sign that, we must love him because there's no sign he loves us. Well, United States exceptionalism has been based on the fact that America's been the most fortunate country in history for the last 200 years. And once its fortune, good fortune, runs out, I think you'll find the end of American exceptionalism pretty quickly. And isolationism will come very much to the fore, a country that will feel very sorry for itself at that point. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. Regime change, well, there used to be a saying amongst neoconservatives after the fall of Baghdad, after Baghdad, Beijing. Let's go for the big one next year or the year after that. It is, of course. I mean, it is worrying. You talked about its strategic engagement. You have a Chinese government that when it sits down with the Americans twice a year, sees a country in terminal decline. Historical forces are against it. It's only a matter before the West vanishes from history. And that's rather depressing to know that your interlocutors have that view of you. But on the other hand, the Chinese know that their American counterparts think that it's an illegitimate regime. It shouldn't be in power. And hopefully it will collapse as soon as possible and a nice democracy will come into place. That's not a very good basis for strategic engagement unless you're dealing with two countries that basically are status quo and that want a quiet life and that do deals with each other. Mm. And neither the United States nor China are status quo countries, I think, in that sense. And they're both going to have to adjust to that reality. So, yeah, there is a strategic engagement, but it's on a very thin foundation.
Okay, thank you, Christopher. Barry, over to you.
Yeah, On the question of exceptionalism, just to add to what Christopher said, I think the interesting thing in comparing the exceptionalism of the United States and China is they're at opposite ends of the spectrum. Right? The Americans, if I can simplify in a rather heroic way, the Americans basically expect everybody to end up being American, so it's a kind of Star Trek vision. Somehow America has discovered everything right and good, and that everybody else will end up there by some liberal teleology. The catchphrase for China that always strikes me is Chinese characteristics, which says exactly the opposite. It says, we are us, and we are really weird and strange, and you don't even need to bother trying to be like us. We don't want you to be like us, actually. We just want to do our own thing and stay, you know, we're our own world. Go away. Right? So America wants to be the world, and China wants to be its own world. So the dynamics of the exceptionalisms, I think, are quite different, and that's the interesting point about them. Robert's question there, how do I see the BRI and all of that? Mm. I mean, I think there are lots of ways of seeing the BRI, everything from industrial policy for China on up. But perhaps the interesting one from the angle that you're looking at is that it can really be seen as a kind of continentalist strategy. Now, if you want to get really wicked and annoy and offend lots of people, it's a little bit like the Japanese strategy in the Second World War, which was to create a continental bastion big enough to stand off the West. Right, that's basically what the Japanese were about, and the Chinese seem to be trying to do something similar with BRI. In other words, to create a big zone which centers on China and which provides them with an alternative to the American Western maritime strategy. So I think if you want to start thinking about that whole set of issues, that's probably as good a place to start as any. The fact that the Chinese are also in Africa and South America and anywhere else you care to name doesn't really matter, okay? It's a global economy, everybody trades, but that's quite different from trying to, as it were, take over the world and become the global hegemon, and I don't see China as doing that. On the question of strategic distrust, that question takes me back to the art of war. I mean, you said the Chinese were reading the art of war and were unpicking Western alliances on that basis, but that Westerners were reading Clausewitz and not understanding it. But Westerners also read the art of war, very popular book in business schools, blah, blah, blah. Now, it's a pretty impenetrable little book, but I've plowed my way through it, and there's one thing that comes out very, very clearly from that book is deception, right? The art of war is the art of deception.
Okay.
Now, therefore, every Westerner who reads that book and is thinking about China in strategic terms is not going to be thinking about strategic trust, right? Because they say, these people, a bit like the Japanese before them, if I may offend people again, you know, it's about the art of deception. It's about surprise attacks. It's about going around the outside and all of that. And that's what the art of Chinese warfare was about. So you're not going to expect to find a lot of strategic trust on that basis.
Mm. Just coming back, though, just quickly, sorry to pick it up, Jerry, but on Robert's point there, I mean, aren't you slightly pushing Chinese ambitions a little bit lower down the scale than they should be? I mean, after all, President Xi Jinping made a rather important speech at Davos in January 2017 saying, well, we're in favor of globalization. The 16 plus one in relationship to the EU does look something rather innovative and very worrying, frankly, for the EU in Brussels. China's now a major donor and a major player in Africa, as it is in South America. It's technological shifts. I mean, it is going global, and it is precisely that, and it's not just regional. I think that was the point, just to pick it up. And it's precisely because of that global ambition, whether it's going to rule the world, as Mr. Martin Jake said 10 years ago, it's not a totally different question. But there is an issue there that if it is a global challenge, then the United States is seeing it as a global challenge and not purely as a regional one.
Yeah, but this puts the whole thing too much in terms of two superpowers and a new bipolarity and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just not thinking
like
that way.
Do you?
No, I don't. Right. It seems to me that's disrespectful to the rest of the world. It's an interesting question. What's China's region, right? China, like Russia, is a hell of a big place, and therefore it abuts on lots of other places. So when we think of China's region, are we thinking of East Asia, or are we thinking of Asia Pacific, or the Indo-Pacific, or are we thinking all the way to Eastern Europe? I mean, what exactly are we are we thinking here now that President Putin has sold Russia to the Chinese?
Not yet.
Maybe there's a bit more ambition there. But it seems to me, if you stop and think about that, now, there's a lot of pretty substantial places in that region. I mean, Russia, even though it's declining, and Mick is going to remind me that I've always said Russia is down and out and not coming back, but it's still consequential. Yeah. India is not declining. There's a lot of very powerful big countries in China's region. So to some extent, I'm not so worried about the rise. China's not the only country out there that's rising. Everybody's rising. China is a bit spectacular at the moment, but hey, as everybody has commented here, it just slowed down. And if you're right, that's a kind of fixture. Mm. And a lot of economists argue that China has now reached this point where it can no longer throw money and people and capital at things and expect to get a lot of growth out of it because they're diminishing returns. Mm. Doesn't need more railways, more airports, that kind of stuff. So China has in some sense peaked, maybe. A lot of the countries in the region haven't peaked. This may be a problem that takes care of itself.
Okay. Cherry, any quick points? Yeah. Then we go for a second round.
Quick point on BRI. Again, I want to say things. Nuance in here is much required. So if you look at China's activities on BRI countries, alongside 88 BRI countries, you see a significant differences between how China behave in its own periphery, like, for example, in Southeast Asia and South Asia, and in contrast to China's behavior in the Middle East, for example. China's behavior in the Middle East has been quite reticent. And China actually does not really share any conflicts with the United States, with the Middle East, in terms of infrastructure building, in terms of letting the United States provide a security umbrella, and then Chinese earn all the money. So when it comes to the discussion on BRI, I think we should really be careful is exactly what China's priority is. And obviously, the priority is on the periphery, and therefore you see much more politicized investment, much more politicized activities around China's border than anywhere else. So that's one thing. And secondly, on Walter's question on survival and existential threat of the Communist Party. Mm-hmm. And the one trap we talk about tonight is two cities trap. Now, there's another Greek mythologist, and Xi Jinping brought up in his New Year's speech this year, he's talking about the Tacitus trap, which is, means the party perhaps one day would lose the credibility to its own people. So that actually indicates clearly the party aware all this crisis and all this lack of trust already breeding within among the ordinary population. But it's really a matter of way and how does somehow the party would regain the trust from its own people. Mm. So I think that's another trap, beginning with T, we should be really careful in the years to come.
Mm-hmm. Just one point on BRI. Has anyone audited BRI? How much money it's making or how much money
losing.
It's losing? Yeah, losing, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 97% participation rate on by SOE. So BRI, yeah, maybe good idea to export China's excess capacity. But right now, in an environment, you know, where China's own domestic resources are relatively stretched, it's becoming extremely unpopular domestically, I might add. And secondly, it just might, you know, collapse under its own weight, right? Just look at what's happened in Malaysia and all, and its, objects, you know, are variable as well, you know, so to speak. So I think compared to a few years ago, you know, BRI is probably something, from West's point of view, they could worry a little less about it. Yeah. Now, if it's converting to something with full Western participation, a bit of Chinese credit enhancement to subsidize an American bank or an American company, for example, I think that could build a lot of goodwill, right? So,
Just one quick historical analogy. I'm old enough to remember the 1980s when there were book after book was written on Japan becoming number one. Do you remember that? Paul Kennedy, Japan, the number one power. Japan is going to, you know, run the world. And then a lot of shady American businessmen and others came along and sold the Japanese pigs in pokes. And boy, oh boy, how much money did the Japanese lose? And I'm not saying it's the same, but I think there is an element of the BRI itis, which reminds me a lot of that kind of misreading or misunderstanding of a certain particular kind of challenge. I don't know. But that's where it's here. We'll take one more round of questions because we want to finish it. There's a very, very tall hand over here, and there's two hands over here on my...
on my left, politically or otherwise. Could you stand up with a... Thank you. Hi.
Hi, I'm a student from King's. And how is it likely that Chinese territorial claims in Asia lead to a serious military confrontation in a way that Russia asserted its militarily in Georgia and Ukraine, in a so-called sphere of influence?
Right.
And what would be the U.S. response? And yeah. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, spheres of influence, Monroe Doctrine, and all that. Okay, there's a chap there. Yeah, okay.
Sorry, we've only got one and one at the back, and that'll do. Yeah, hi there.
Jake, I'm also from across the road at King's.
Hey, welcome.
I have a more of an nice open-ended question. I think it was Professor Buzan who mentioned that other countries are also rising. So my question is more open-ended, and it's sort of directed towards Europe and India, and what role, if any, do they have in sort of the... conflict elements of the rise of China.
Thank you. The one country we can leave out of the rising category is the United Kingdom, for the obvious reasons, which are demonstrated today in the House of Commons. And one last question about that. Hi.
My name is Josh. I'm asking more from an investor standpoint. We've seen the case with Huawei, and I just want to ask, do you think we should start to really avoid companies with any exposure between the two bilateral trade?
Do you think we're going to give you cheap advice?
No.
Good God, man. Come and talk to him privately, and I'll work out the contract and take 20%. Okay, let's... Barry, why don't you kick off there on those, and then last round of questions.
Last round of answers.
I'm not sure I have a lot to say on any of these questions.
Come on.
Chinese territorial claims in Asia, will they lead to serious confrontation? Well, I've kind of argued already... No, that all of the countries around China are playing kind of hedging games. They don't want to be oppositional to China, and they don't want to link themselves too closely to the U.S., so they're trying to kind of carve a middle path. China doesn't seem very likely to become like Russia in the sense of seizing back. China seems to be relatively self-contained in the sense that very prepared to use force for what it thinks of as its already established domestic sphere, which does include Taiwan, right? Mm. So we can't judge China in relation to the rest of the world by its relationship with Taiwan. It seems to me you have to allow, even though if things turn nasty between China and Taiwan, that would have implications for the rest of the world and it would change the way China was seen. It seems to me that's, within China, that's a different kind of logic in and of itself, and that China is not looking like Russia has been looking to reassert a lost sphere. It has its sphere, except for Taiwan, and there's some, the South China Sea and a few other islands are kind of leftover awkward issues here, but I think you need to see those separately from the general relations, and so far I don't think China is going to be expansionist in the sense of trying to recover or looking for confrontation on other than that specific set of issues which it thinks of already as kind of internal issues. I'm not sure I understand the question about when you say other countries are also rising and you point to India and Europe. Whether Europe is rising is an interesting question, which you probably shouldn't get into, but it does seem to me that we're looking at a world with multiple centers of wealth and power and cultural authority. But also a very interdependent and tightly connected world, which will share a number of fates, things that will need to be managed. Planetary defense, for those of you who are space cadets and worry about meteorites hitting the planet. Global diseases. Managing the global trading system in some way. Climate change. All of those things are shared fate problems which are not really very divisible and which will require some kind of shared management. But otherwise, my sense of where this system goes is that a bit like China, there will be a lot of centers that basically want to be left to get on with their own business within a global trading system and within some kind of management regime for shared fate problems, but not in this kind of, so it's a post-Western world, right? The Western world was a kind of teleology, liberal teleology, in which everything was supposed to end up looking like the West. That idea, it seems to me, is dead, and we need to get used to the idea that we're moving forward into a more multicultural, more decentered world, which will evolve down several different kinds of pathways. It's just a very different sort of world, but it's one that I quite welcome. I mean, I'm fed up with American hegemony and think that they've long passed their sell-by date in terms of doing a good job at leading things. Let's try something else.
Okay, that's a challenge. Charing, any final observations?
Final remarks, I mean, on the sphere of influence, I'm not quite sure that really China want to extend its own sphere of influence, you know, in that normative sense, like Americans, like the Europeans really want to do. I mean, if we compare it with China and Russia, one of the area we can really carefully look at into is the Central Asia. Central Asia, of course, is one of the key strategic areas for China on the Belt and Road Initiative. But if we carefully look into China's engagement in Central Asia, it's purely and simply on the economic terms. And China is actually quite happy to left Russia to continue to extend its own sphere of Slavic influence. I mean, that's
but
a really...
Can I just jump in there? I mean, the British, no doubt, in the 18th and 19th centuries, said the East India Company, perfectly nice commercial enterprise, all we want to do is make money. And then they found that making money actually, put it rather crudely, the flag followed. Now, I'm not saying China's going to be like the British Empire, God forbid.
Or wouldn't they be so lucky?
What a nice moment,
but,
huh?
It's not enough, it seems to me, to just say it's economic. And then, because we had British colonial rule after 1857, because the East India Company could no longer run it. So,
I mean, my view is like until we reach certain turning point and somehow one day China would now actively looking for extend its sphere of influence. But so far, we're not really on that stage.
Okay.
Now, on the question on rising powers on EU and India, I can say a bit about the European Union. I mean, at the end of the day, China actually initially had high hope on the European Union would somehow would replacing or even at least on parallel with the United States as being the multipolar, one of the important pole of the international affairs. But then somehow European Union have not really stand up for it. And then what China's hope towards the European Union has seems to be gone diminishing completely. Because at the end of the day, whatever European Union does towards China is not dependent on how much China is willing to do it, but it's rather it's a European internal governance issue. How Brussels can make sure the needs and wants of Hungary, for example, will be the same with the needs and wants of Germany. And so far, we have not got an answer. And European Union is so much intertwined with its own internal debate. So, not sure.
Okay, Christopher, any final comments?
Well, on the territorial claims, as I said before, China's actually settled all its territorial claims with its neighbours on terms which actually are quite favourable to many of them, surprisingly enough. But there is, of course, one territorial claim that is outstanding that hasn't been made, and that is that if you look at what China was back in the 1860s, it was a tenth larger than it is today. It lost a tenth of its territory to Russia. The Russians, you may have read last week, have made their peace finally with Japan, so they've settled the outstanding territorial claims there. What are the Russians going to do about this? Should the Chinese ever decide the revenge of history after the British and the evil Western barbarians, it's time for the to deal with the Russians. 37% of Russian armed forces are stationed permanently on the frontier with China. They tend to be the most efficient, actually, of the Russian armed forces because, of course, the Russians know NATO is never going to invade them, but they do fear that China one day will. They're incapable of actually defending that frontier because it's so large. Just look at the map. There's a joke in the People's Liberation Army that should we ever invade Russia, we'll never win because we won't be able to find them. So, which is why they rely entirely on theater nuclear weapons for the defense of that frontier. And that is mainstream Russian doctrine. We will defend our territories with nuclear weapons, which means it'll be unlivable for both of us. So there's not much point. So anyway, that's something to look at some point in the future, but certainly not now. And as Barry said, Putin is well on the way to selling Russia out to China for his own regime purposes. But whoever replaces him will, I think, be a nationalist, and will have different ideas about the relationship between Russia and China. And on India, well, the Indians are constitutionally incapable of thinking strategically. So look at the way in which they have been completely and utterly outfoxed by the Chinese. coming to their aid at the very last minute are the Australians, the Japanese, and the European Union, which are now talking about a new Indo-Pacific theater, where you'll have some European warships, a British base, by the way, in Asia, helping out the Indians with a one ship that will be available. The Chinese increase their navy by the size of the Royal Navy, the entire Royal Navy, every year. So that's the extent to which the Chinese Navy is rising. It's already almost as large as the American, will overtake the U.S. Navy by 2025 at the latest. We have a new theater of operations. It's called the Indo-Pacific, and that is where the great powers are now concentrating their attention. As I said once to an Indian official, head of the military intelligence, however much you may dislike the British, and unfortunately our present government doesn't realize how much Indians hate the British, we did at least put the Indian in ocean for you. Do you intend to keep it the Indian Ocean or not? And he said, that is non-negotiable. It remains the Indian Ocean. So that's it. You know, that's the red line which the Indians have drawn for themselves. Right. Let's see what happens over the next few years.
Okay. And any investment advice, free?
So a few quick points on that. So having a good navy is no substitute for good leadership and naval tradition, right? So we saw that during the Xiaowu War with the Japanese and towards the end of the Qing Empire. So I think there's a cautionary tale there. And in terms of territorial claims, there was a very good piece by interesting piece by Jamil Andolini on whether Pakistan can become a colony of China by accident. So here's a very interesting point. Going back to BRI, has anyone done an audit of that or China's overseas investments? If there was a strong claim, take Venezuela, for example. What's China's recourse, to the money that has been sunk there? Can China, try to actually recover some of the debt, as in all of the international investors have done so, suing by New York courts, by the way, Venezuela? Why is international debt issued primarily in London and in New York, right? Because you actually have recourse to that. So I think these are very important points. In terms of investment, so Huawei's not listed, so you won't have to worry about that in either direction. But overly, I'll focus on the opportunities. If China does rebalance, then the companies which sell, luxury goods, which sell services, which sell content to China. And that's what exceptionalism is about, right? Disney has two theme parks in China. Is any Chinese big theme park ever going to be built in Chinese students? I remember back in 1990, when was it? After they hit the embassy with the missiles, 1999, right?
Yeah.
And we were saying, we're seeing the university students protest in the morning, off to the U.S. embassy for a visa application in the afternoon. And that's exceptions.
We've heard a great phrase there, colony by accident. I think I'll take that one home. A great Norwegian Cold War historian, Geir Lundestad, many years ago wrote a wonderful article. He talked about America and Europe being an empire by invitation. Now I've heard of colonialism by accident. It sounds like the British. Didn't we get an empire because we didn't know quite what we were doing?
Absence of mind.
Absence of mind. Good God, we've got an empire, chaps. Well, here we are. We certainly don't have one now. Anyway, I'd firstly like to thank our speakers, Jeffrey, Christopher, Barry and Cherry. I'd also like to thank very much Gideon Gautel here and our friends from the China Development Forum. I wonder if you could put your hands together and say thank you to the speakers.